From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's a busy day. Later in the program, we'll go to the Minneapolis area to hear about yesterday's fatal police shooting of a black man after a traffic stop less than 10 miles from the trial of Derek Chauvin. But first to Windsor, Virginia, where the police department is under state investigation. An officer has been fired, and disturbing video has gone public showing two officers pepper spraying Caron Nazario, a black and Latino Army lieutenant, during a traffic stop last December. Officers said they tried to get him to pull over, but he took well over a minute. Lieutenant Nazario was seen telling officers he slowed down and signaled, but waited to find a safe spot. As soon as he did, he saw two officers with guns drawn on him. They then pepper sprayed him when he didn't get out of the car.
Is your commanding officer available?
Down! Let's go!
Is your commanding Let's officer go. Available?
Get on the ground now!
Lieutenant Nazario has now filed a lawsuit against those two officers, claiming they violated his constitutional rights. Jane Harper is a courts and crime reporter for the Virginian Pilot. Jane, you were the first to report police body camera video. This is last week. There's also video from Lieutenant Nazario that he began rolling from his car. Yours really went viral.
Yes, I knew it was going to be, you know, it was going to probably take off, but it was much more so than I expected. I've just been, you know, bombarded with emails and phone calls, and it's been overwhelming.
Yeah. Well, Nazario claims the officers gave him conflicting orders, you know, put up your hands and fasten your seatbelt. He says that Officer Gutierrez, who has been fired, told him he was fixing to ride the lightning, meaning Nazario was fixing to ride the lightning. Nazario thought he was going to die. Others said that just meant taser. What? Stop there. What did that language mean?
The attorney actually added something to the lawsuit saying that that's a reference to the electric chair. And I actually heard since then that in the movie The Green Mile, that term was used. And okay. I believe it was in reference to the electric chair.
Well, the town of Windsor's town manager said in a statement that an internal investigation found the officers who pulled Nazario over, this is Joe Gutierrez and Daniel Crocker, didn't follow departmental policy. They were disciplined, ordered to take additional training. Gutierrez was later fired. What else from any corner are you hearing?
Well, there's been a lot of calls for investigations. Pretty much every politician from Virginia, it seems like, has spoken out on this. There's been calls for a state investigation, which is happening, and a federal investigation. I haven't heard anything happening with that. And the NAACP from the county there is holding a press conference this evening to discuss it.
Yeah. And back to some of the language of Officer Gutierrez, again, who's been fired in particular, at a time when we have a larger picture of police encounters that yesterday left another black man dead in a Minneapolis suburb just miles from the Derek Chauvin trial. Your colleague, the Virginia Pilot reporter, Anna Lay, tweeted, "I'm a brown Latina with a red car who's taken many nervous drives through Windsor, and she felt sick to her stomach when she read in your report last week that Gutierrez, when he was talking to the Army lieutenant, as they seemed to try to de-escalate the whole encounter, he said, 'We get a lot of people who say they want to stop in a safe spot. And, you know, 80% of the time, it's a minority.' Meanwhile, this raises a lot of questions about what, you know, legal questions. The police are saying he should have pulled right over. The Army lieutenant is saying, 'No, I have the right to find a safe spot if I've signaled and slowed down.' One of the officers is heard saying on his body camera, 'We now have a felony pullover because he wouldn't stop.' Is that true? I mean, have you looked into some of the legal questions here?
No, and I do plan to look into that because I'm curious, you know, for my own self, are we allowed to wait until we find a lighted spot? You know, are we required to pull over immediately? Can you be ordered out of your car? You know, I think those are all good questions that every driver would, you know, like to know. It just seemed crazy that it was considered eluding police when he slowed his car down, put on his signal. I don't see how that's eluding.
We know also that Governor Ralph Northam said he was angered by this incident back in December, and he's going to invite the officer for a meeting to discuss police reform.
Yes. And I talked to his attorney this morning. I don't know if they've set that up yet. He did say that Lieutenant Nazario was still dealing with the whole traffic incident to begin with. But now he's you know, known all across the country. And that's kind of freaked him out, too.
Yeah. Jane Harper, a courts and crime reporter for the Virginia Pilot. Thank you.
Thank you.
Pressure is mounting for countries to boycott the 2022 Winter Olympic Games in Beijing. The outcry is tied to China's alleged human rights abuses against Uyghur Muslims in the Xinjiang province. The Chinese government is accused of committing genocide, and Amnesty International estimates that thousands of Uyghur children have been separated from their parents. CNN's David Culver recently traveled to Xinjiang, where he found two children separated from their parents, and he joins us now via Skype. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks, Tanya. Good to be with you.
Yes, great to have you. So the first child you were able to track down was a 10-year-old daughter of a man who hasn't seen his wife or children since 2015. His wife and children were supposed to be on a routine trip but never returned. How did you find this daughter?
When we got there, we spent the first 24 hours and 20,000 steps on the ground going through these back streets of this little town, not finding anything. And it wasn't until the next day did we stumble in and realize that his daughter, who we matched through the only videos he had of her from a few years before, was standing right in front of us.
Wow. So you found this daughter, Mulisa is her name, living with Mahmoud John's parents in southern Xinjiang. And she told you that she missed her father. And you actually was able to record this and you showed it to her father, Mahmoud John. Here he is reacting to that encounter. Let's listen.
Poor thing. What kind of country does this to people, to the innocent people?
That's heartbreaking. It's very hard to listen to. What did you discover about the past 5 years of Mulisa's life? Did you find out what happened to her mother and brother?
She says that she misses her mom and dad. I mean, she's an 11-year-old girl. She is clearly very intelligent, but she had a broken heart. And she said on occasion, she talked to her mom, but she didn't give much detail. When we asked, is your mom in a detention camp? She told us she couldn't talk about camps. That was a subject we couldn't go into. And each time she was trying to go to her grandparents to vet whether or not she could answer certain things. So she was very careful. And then at one point we realized our conversation had come to an end because authorities had notified the family that they were to stop talking to us.
I'm just curious how long you were there before authorities were called in.
We were there roughly about 10 minutes, enough to kick off our shoes and to almost join them for a meal. They were preparing for a feast, and they wanted us to stay, interestingly enough.
I want to step back a little bit, because when you talk about what happened at Mulisa's house with authorities, when you were flying into Xinjiang, you said that the cabin crew made everyone close their window shades on the plane's descent, presumably so you wouldn't see the labor camps from the sky. You also described being followed by who you suspect were Chinese security forces by car and on foot. Can you tell us more about that?
I can't say for certain why they wanted us to close the window shades, but it was peculiar because usually they're saying open them for takeoff and landing. When we were on the ground and being followed, we knew early on that there were people trailing us. At one moment, we tried to go through a toll where police stopped us, and they went from our car, knowing that we were journalists after checking our passports, to the car behind us, and then allowed us to continue going. But then as they realized who we were trying to connect with, they then started to follow us in droves. But that was the reality, is they wanted to make sure that their presence was known and that anyone we were going to speak with, they too would be tracking.
Amnesty International says the Chinese government is intentionally separating these families in retaliation for parents leaving Xinjiang during the early days of the crackdown. I mean, this is a charge that the Chinese government denies. Here's Chinese ambassador to the U.S., Suyi Tiankai, responding to your report with an interview with CNN's Christiane Amanpour.
Frankly, there has been so much fabrication so far, so I cannot.
But you know that that's not fabricated, Ambassador, right?
It's very unfortunate.
You know that that's not fabricated.
It's very unfortunate. I think it's very unfortunate. It's immoral to take advantage of any particular family situation and manipulate. This is not true journalism. It's very unfortunate for CNN.
David, has the Chinese government changed its tone at all now that more countries are speaking out against these alleged human rights abuses?
Tanya, they've gone the opposite direction. They have doubled down on this, and they maintain that this is a false narrative, that these are lies that are being put out with regards to what's happening in Xinjiang. I think that's what makes this story stand on its own, is that we are simply putting forward what parents who are outside of the country are venting to us and pleading, really in a desperate situation with us, to connect with their children. And we are attempting to find the children and hear their side of it.
David, thank you so much for talking with us, and thank you for your reporting.
Tanya, thanks for giving us some time.
That's CNN's David Culver on his recent reporting from China's Xinjiang province. President Biden is meeting with a group of Republican lawmakers at the White House today in an attempt to gather support for his American Jobs Plan. One major component of that $2 trillion infrastructure proposal is a promise to clean up the country's electricity system. To do that, the plan sets new mandates for renewable energy and calls for an overhaul of the electric grid. And for more, let's bring in Leah Stokes, a political scientist at the University of California, Santa Barbara. She joins us on Skype. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, thank you for being here. So this plan promises $100 billion to overhaul the country's electric grid and really make it more resilient to climate disasters. You actually studied the electric grid. What are some of the most important things that you feel need to change to realize this ambitious goal?
Well, one of the first things to note is that it's not only $100 billion for the electricity grid. It turns out that they didn't score key tax credits in the proposal that they put out. And so the number for the electricity grid is closer to $400 or $500 billion. And that's really good news, because we have so many things we have to do to our electricity grid to make it more resilient and reliable, as we've seen with outages caused by heat waves in California or the massive cold snap in Texas. So these investments will really be important to be cleaning up our air, making our electricity system more stable, and really, of course, delivering on climate stability as well.
You know, if this bill should pass, how are you actually hoping the government will spend this money? This is a lot of money.
Well, there's two big things that need to be part of a package coming out of Congress on the electricity grid. The first is extensions of tax credits. So a big way that we've built a lot of wind and solar and other clean electricity in this country is through tax credits. And these tax credits, unlike fossil fuel subsidies, expire regularly. And so the idea is to extend them for 10 years and turn them into a direct pay mechanism. What does that mean? It just means that even if you don't have tax liability, you can still use this resource. But the other really big piece is a clean electricity standard. A clean electricity standard is an idea that's been pioneered in a majority of states across the country that says that we need to increase the amount of renewables and other clean electricity. And President Biden actually ran on saying he wanted 100% clean electricity by 2035.
As you just said, I mean, this is something that lots of states have, this increase in their share of clean electricity through something that's like this. But how exactly do you think that this would work on a federal level?
Oh, it's so exciting. It would move us from about 40% clean electricity today, right now in the United States, to 80% clean electricity by 2030, in the next decade. You know, we need to be investing in our grid to making it more resilient as climate impacts like heat waves and hurricanes start to accelerate.
Well, much like you, President Biden is calling this a once-in-a-generation investment. But others say it actually pales in comparison to the scale of the climate crisis. For example, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez called the proposal not nearly enough. We've also heard something similar from the Sunrise Movement. How do these climate measures and this bill actually compare to what is ultimately needed?
Well, it's important to remember that this is just an opening bid from the White House. They've put forward a plan. On the face, it looks like it's $2 trillion. But if you put in those tax credits that I've been talking about, it's actually closer to $3 trillion. And just a few days before the plan came out, a coalition of environmental groups, including Sunrise and important labor groups like the IBEW and important environmental justice groups like WEACT, they all signed a letter saying that they wanted $4 trillion of spending. And I think the reality is that it's great if individuals like Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and groups are pushing Congress to go bigger and bolder on the climate crisis, because this is a really huge challenge that's on our doorstep and also a very big opportunity. But Congress is ultimately the body that gets to legislate. Mm-hmm. So this could get bigger as we move forward.
I mean, and it also could look altogether different based on what happens in Congress, if it even passes. And, you know, these climate provisions, I mean, the reality is they may face a challenge. For instance, moderate Democrats like Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, he actually said just last month, quote, although fossil fuel consumption is dropping and the U.S. power grid, the global trends in fossil fuel use should make us all recognize that fossil fuels aren't going anywhere anytime soon, particularly in countries that are seeking to expand access to electricity and energy in order to address poverty. I mean, with all of this in mind, this bigger picture in mind, what measures do you think are going to make it in the final version of this law? And really, are you worried the climate aspects of this are going to get watered down?
You know, I am very hopeful. I'm even hopeful about Senator Manchin. The reality is that Senator Manchin understands that the climate crisis is a very big crisis, and he may have different ideas about solutions to the problem, but he has signaled consistently in the media that this is something that he wants to work on, infrastructure in general, climate policy in specific. And he is the chairman of the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, where a lot of this legislation will move through. The reality is we have to make these policies work for all parts of the country. So I'm an optimist, and I think that we finally have a situation in Congress where we're likely to see a lot of alignment. And you can see that, for example, at the end of last year when Senator Murkowski and Senator Manchin passed a bill that included really important climate provisions, as well as important spending on energy. So I think that there is space to see movement. And I'm very hopeful that we will get finally some comprehensive climate legislation out of Congress this year.
Leah Stokes is a political scientist at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you.
Well, it's been a while since we updated the news from the world of mermaids and their fans. So here we go. Two new museums devoted to mermaids have opened recently, independent of each other. One's on the East Coast in Florida, the other on the West Coast. That's where we're going with Tom Bonzi from the Northwest News Network. He dove into the scene near Aberdeen, Washington.
There were multiple mermaid sightings in the past week here at Grays Harbor on the central Washington coast. One was spotted playing a harp. People observed another with a gray and white tail reclining on a mermaid throne. Yet another, get this, appeared at a book signing. The liveliest one twirled in front of the underwater viewing window of a traveling show tank painted in turn of the century circus style.
It was cool. She dropped a shell for us.
Hello, I am Una the Mermaid. I am 41 years old. I am a professional mermaid from Portland, Oregon, and I have been doing this since about 2012.
Okay. There's a crab just floating in the background.
Would you like a shell?
Yeah. There was something magical about the silence of being underwater and just hearing music and then seeing littles approach and just getting excited. And I just love that. I love that magic. I like making people happy.
You guys got to meet a real-life mermaid today. Thank you. Thanks, Una.
Una says she missed out on some of her childhood because of abuse. She says she took on the mermaid identity in part to connect with her daughter in a playful, imaginative way.
Also a journey on how I found my own personal healing as a survivor of family trauma and violence and reconnecting with one's inner child and helping others to reconnect with that as well. So that's a big part of who I am and why I do what I do.
The grand opening of the International Mermaid Museum provided an occasion for many mermaids to gather. Una says a group of mermaids is called a pod. The Portland, Oregon area is home to several. Seattle, San Francisco, Nashville, and Baltimore are some of the other places with sizable pods. The merfolk include men and women and all body types. Some people splash into mermaiding as a hobby or for exercise. Others make it a side gig by hiring themselves out for birthday parties, events, and photo ops.
Oh, the sand dollar, good choice.
The Mermaid Museum in Washington State is a project of the Roberts family. Founder Kim Roberts says she heard the sirens call after undergoing cancer treatment
4 years ago, and it started to matter to me what I was leaving. And we didn't know if I would still be here today. And so this is my thing. This is my legacy.
A family friend's donation of a massive shell collection got the ball rolling. The museum displays feature lots of mermaid mannequins. Robert says there's a point here besides conveying mermaid lore. She wants each exhibit to teach ocean ecology, too.
The mermaids are the spoonful of sugar to make the medicine go down. As if we just built an ocean ecology museum, I'm not sure it would have as much interest as a mermaid museum. But we can tell both those stories together.
A mother from Shelton, Washington, Rochelle Freeman, says she came away inspired to plunge in.
As a kid, I always imagined myself as an ocean creature, so I got my first monofin last year, and I made my own mermaid tail at home. So that's been really fun and a really cool way for me to express my artistic side during all this COVID stuff going on. And
Freeman says she was introduced to mermaiding by YouTube videos.
And I've just been seeing it online, and so to actually meet ladies who are doing this all the time and actually seeing it as a reality is really awesome.
Admission to the West Coast Mermaid Museum is free for the rest of this month, maybe longer. The newly opened East Coast Mermaid Museum is heavy on art, artifacts, and oddities. It's in the small town of Berlin, Maryland, near the Atlantic beaches. For Here and Now, I'm Tom Bonsi outside Aberdeen, Washington.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
Whether you're looking to discover a new series to binge, find your next great read, or check out that movie everyone's talking about, NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast is your guide to all things entertainment. Every weekday, we keep pop culture in high spirits. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
The American Academy of Pediatrics reports that 284 children in the U.S. have died of COVID-19 as of April 1st, 2021. And today we want to remember just one of them. Aurea Sotoyulatsin Morales was 8 years old and known by her family and friends as Yoshi. She was an avid student, fun-loving girl in second grade. Cole Del Charco from member station WUNC has this portrait of the first child in North Carolina to die of COVID.
In a sun-soaked apartment in southwest Durham, Yoshi's mother, Araceli Morales Martinez, wears a mask and weaves through cards and notes from her daughter's classmates and friends. Morales Martinez keeps the box close by, under a table in the living room, a table filled with photos of Yoshi.
Aquí tiene una foto con sus compañeritos. Aquí está ella. Aquí ella está.
Morales Martinez shows me a picture of Yoshi with her classmates and some of her favorite things on the table. Some of her favorite snacks, her Bible, and some things they had with her at the hospital. Even at 8, Yoshi was a dedicated vegetarian and wouldn't eat meat because it harmed animals. She loved cats and endangered red pandas and had a stuffed animal of one that sits on the table in the living room. Gentian is Yoshi's sister and was her best friend. They shared a room and bonded over late-night talks. They loved to travel and listen to music. Gentian remembers a time their family was driving back to Durham from the mountains.
One of her favorite songs was Du Hast, and she would always be headbanging to that song. She said, "Don't tell anyone," and one day we were in the van. The song came up, and she was headbanging in the back seat. And then my parents noticed, and she got embarrassed of us seeing her headbanging. And so we just turned it up, and we started headbanging with her.
Her father, Salvador Soto, says even though she went by Yoshi, her given name of Yolatsin had a special meaning, Little Heart of Gold.
No, yo no soy ese, dice, yo no soy ese, yo soy Yoshi. Sí, me decía, yo no soy el dinosaurio, dice, yo soy única.
But she would always say, I'm not Yoatsin, I'm Yoshi, I'm unique. When he thinks of her, he remembers his daughter's strength.
Yo sí la recuerdo como una niña fuerte, inteligente. Es mi única hija y...
Yoshi was a child of God, he says. He remembers her as an angel.
Yo sí la recuerdo como un ángel, una estrella divina.
A star, alive. The family says they did everything they could to avoid getting COVID-19, but somehow they all contracted the virus in June. Everyone else got better quickly, but Yoshi began to react badly. After several days in the hospital, she died. Having a normal funeral during the pandemic last June wasn't really possible, so they reached out to Durham Public Schools to see if they could hold a small service outside at Creekside Elementary, Yoshi's school. They did, and lots of family and friends came by in their cars. They had a minister and spoke and prayed in remembrance. They also planted a tree at the school, a Japanese maple with white leaves. And when they did, her sister says they put a piece of Yoshi's hair in the soil.
Within that, I believe, like, she will continue to grow. Even without us seeing her physically, she would continue growing, like, spiritually with the tree alongside.
For Here and Now, I'm Cole Del Charco.
In New York, there's now a focus on workers who lost income during the last year because of COVID-19, but weren't eligible for unemployment or stimulus relief because they're undocumented. After protests by supporters, including a hunger strike, the state is offering one-time payments of up to $15,600 to the estimated 290,000 undocumented immigrants who lost jobs during the pandemic and can prove it. The $2.1 billion fund is by far the biggest of its kind in the country. Jessica Ramos is a New York State senator representing parts of Queens who helped lead the push for this fund. Senator Ramos, Republicans say there shouldn't be taxpayer money going to undocumented immigrants when legal residents are in need. But there was also a battle within your Democratic Party. Some worry this fund will haunt Democrats in future elections. So what was your argument for this fund?
You know, they've been out there peddling talking points against the Excluded Workers Fund, but they barely debated me or asked me about their concerns on the Senate floor. And I think most people realize what a huge economic stimulus it is to help anyone who is behind on rent and having trouble making ends meet in our communities, because that will create more disposable income and hopefully keep our economic corridors vibrant. But I do hear a lot of resentment. Oh, you know, why are you utilizing my tax dollars to help these folks? It's actually their tax dollars too. In fact, in 2019, undocumented New Yorkers contributed $1.4 billion in state taxes. This fund is just $2.1 billion and is a one-time fund.
Well, but you also make the point that it's, you know, it's an integrated financial system. They will also be paying their bills, which helps other people in New York. And we know that this pandemic disproportionately affected poor communities and communities of color in New York City alone. The Hispanic population had the highest death rate of ethnicities, 350 people for every 100,000. And we know partly that was because they were on the front lines. We're looking at banners during some of these protests saying our labor saved lives. These were people who were working.
That's right. These are people who were keeping, you know, clinics clean, who were working in hospitality, who have been working in construction throughout the pandemic. Look, unemployment was highest among the Latinx community at the peak of the pandemic. And so we have to account for those cracks that the federal wage replacement programs left. And I think that that's what's clear here, is that it's not actually not just for undocumented people. Most of these folks happen to be undocumented, but the program is actually for any worker that didn't qualify for a stimulus check, PUA, or unemployment insurance. And it doesn't do anyone any good if any neighbor is in dire straits and isn't able to keep up with their bills. A landlord doesn't care whether someone's undocumented. They care that they can make their mortgage payment.
So these were people who were working and then lost jobs and lost out on these payments. And they have to prove quite a few things, it seems, in order to get the payments. They have to show a utility bill or show that they paid their taxes. What are some of the things they have to show?
So they have to prove three things. One is proof of identity. You have to prove residency. You have to have been living in New York before March 27th of 2020. That means if you just moved here, you won't be eligible for this. And then for that, you can utilize your utility bill, a bank statement, a letter from your homeless shelter even. Then you have to be able to prove loss of income, which is the whole point. So you can either show your taxes or you can provide other proofs of income, a wide range of things from pay stubs to letters from the employer to punch cards, everything that the court allows as evidence for loss of income in wage and hour violations.
Are you worried that since these people are undocumented, they will be afraid to come forward with all of that identification, which will show where they live?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, an unfortunate truth of living as an undocumented person, and I know what this is like because my parents were undocumented when I was a little girl, is to live in the shadows and be scared of interacting in the society surrounding you. We have to remember, New York State does not share this information with the federal government. Yeah.
New York State Senator Jessica Ramos on the new fund there to pay undocumented immigrants who lost their jobs during COVID and were not eligible for stimulus or unemployment. Senator, thank you.
All right. Thank you for having me.
To Louisville, Kentucky now, and an art exhibit honoring Breonna Taylor, who was shot and killed by Louisville police in March of last year. The exhibit is called Promise, Witness, Remembrance. And as Stephanie Wolf of member station WFPL reports in this story that aired on All Things Considered, Taylor's family played a key role in its development.
Tamika Palmer says the exhibition dedicated to her daughter is everything she hoped it would be.
A peaceful place. Just to be able to come to this place and just be filled with her spirit.
It's been nearly 13 months since Louisville Metro police officers shot and killed Breonna Taylor in her home. And Palmer says she never imagined Taylor would be memorialized this way.
I was in awe, just the thought that people who don't even know her take time out of their day to draw something of her, or even just as simple as her name, and to see it all come together is just a blessing.
Palmer had a hand in developing the show at Louisville Speed Art Museum. So did other family members, local artists, and mental health professionals. The Speed Museum's Toya Northington wanted community members engaged with issues like police brutality and racism to have a voice, but she knew it might be tough to recruit them.
When I ask people to come to the table in a time where we are greatly divided as a community, I'm asking them to come on board and to support this institution that has not been known for their support for Black community and marginalized communities.
Even so, Northington was able to build a planning committee and a team of researchers. They didn't always agree on everything, but there was consensus that this show should primarily feature Black artists.
That was the number one requirement.
Guest curator Allison Glenn worked with these committees as well as national advisors. They encouraged her to arrange the show in a specific part of the museum.
We're sitting in the doorways of the original building that was built in 1927 to house the Speed Art Museum's collection. Typically, this is where you would see the Dutch and Flemish collection.
The space normally holds centuries-old works by artists such as Rembrandt. Every artist in this collection was white.
To have a contemporary exhibition by a majority Black artists in this space acts as a decolonization of these galleries.
The show is laid out in three sections to reflect the words in the title, Promise, Witness, Remembrance. In the first, artists use recognizable American symbols to examine promises made by this nation, like a wall installation of shoelaces spelling out, "We the People."
Just wanted to start a conversation around the founding of these organizing documents that constitute our country and perhaps help us understand how we got there.
Glenn is pointing toward a well-known portrait of Breonna Taylor. It's the centerpiece of the show, featuring Taylor in a flowy aquamarine dress, wearing an engagement ring that her boyfriend never got to give her. It can be seen from every room. Amy Sherald painted it for a Vanity Fair cover last year, and this is the first time it's on public view. In the second section, Witness, artists reflect on contemporary history. Louisville-born artist Noel W. Anderson incorporates images of Black women ripped from old magazines. He erases parts of the picture, leaving just the hint of an eye or a smile.
They require the audience to witness the erasure of this Black woman or these Black women in these images that I have, right? But it also then requires the viewer to also project the promise back onto those empty spaces.
This room also displays photographs from the racial justice protest in Louisville. Tamika Palmer contributed work to the final section, Remembrance. It's a timeline of her daughter's life.
I don't know who else could have told the story. I didn't know how exactly it would even play out, but I just knew that there was a lot of stuff that people still didn't know about her. She died so violently, but to know that she was never a violent person.
Palmer says Taylor was easygoing her whole life. They called her Easy Breezy.
You want people to not forget, to not move on, because the real goal hasn't been served yet.
And that goal, Palmer says, is justice. For NPR News, I'm Stephanie Wolf in Louisville.
Fictionalized account of events leading up to the 1995 massacre of Muslims during the Yugoslav War is now up for an Academy Award in the International Feature Film category. It's called Quo Vadis Aida, and it was directed by Bosnian filmmaker Jasmila Zbanić. Zbanić was living in Vermont when the killings took place. John Kalish reports on the impact working with a Vermont theater group had on the director's artistic development.
In December 1993, Peter Schumann, the director of Vermont's Bread and Puppet Theater, traveled to the Bosnian city of Sarajevo to express solidarity and bear witness. Serbian forces in the mountains surrounding the city were shooting and shelling civilians. For Schumann, the siege was a reminder of a childhood nightmare.
It reminded me so much of my refugee time.
World War II turned Schumann's German family into refugees. As a young boy, he witnessed bombings and saw dead bodies. Schumann was stunned by what students at Sarajevo's Performing Arts Academy endured.
Oh my God, what a time. We were housed in a high-rise building that was half bombed out. The students came by bike or by foot or whatever, and they had to walk through sniper fire. But they came.
One of those students was 19-year-old Jasmila Zbanić. She watched Schumann perform one of his fiddle lectures, a mix of poetic political manifesto, yelps, and chants, accompanied by a droning violin. Here's a taste of one recorded recently in Vermont.
We, non-essentialists, must deliver the missing insurrection and resurrection services that the moment requires. Hey, hey, hey,
hey, hey, hey, hey. Zbanić was impressed with Schumann and he with her. He gave her his fiddle, and when he got back to Vermont, Schumann started calling for airstrikes against Serbian gun positions surrounding Sarajevo, never forgetting the spirited Bosnian college student Jasmila Zbanić. Michael Romanishan is a longtime member of Bread and Puppet Theater.
When he came back, he talked about her. She had made a real impression upon him. She was somebody that had decided one day that she wasn't going to lie in bed and just suffer the depression of the war.
In April 1994, Ramanujan joined Schumann on another visit to Sarajevo, where they watched Zhbanich perform in a small street circus that played out of range of sniper fire. A year later, Zhbanich traveled to Bread and Puppets Farm in Glover, Vermont, where every August crowds of several thousand turn out for 2 days of performances featuring giant puppets and dramatic pageantry. While preparations were underway for the performance, news came of the atrocities in Bosnia, which included the massacre of some 8,000 Muslim boys and men in Srebrenica.
When Srebrenica was taken, it was for people of Bread and Puppet a huge shock. They encouraged me to talk about my stories. And then we did this piece about Srebrenica at that time.
Children were deported from Srebrenica to Tuzla.
Zhbanich insists that the time she spent in Vermont 25 years ago had a huge impact on her artistic vision, including her Oscar-nominated film.
For me, it was very important to see that politics and arts can be joined in something beautiful and powerful. You hear that art is maybe damaged if it's talking about politics in a direct way. But in Bread and Puppet, I learned how art can still talk about urgent issues of our time.
Whether or not Quo Vadis Aida wins the Oscar for International Feature Film later this month, Jasmila Zhbanich will continue making films with her producer husband, who served on a rescue squad during the siege of Sarajevo. She doesn't know what her next project will be, but someday, she says, she'd like to do a film or TV series about the siege. Her 20-year-old daughter is enrolled in Sarajevo's Performing Arts Academy and is planning to follow in her mother's footsteps and write for film and theater. For Here and Now, I'm John Kalish.
This afternoon on All Things Considered, vaccinations and the return to school this fall. About half a dozen colleges and universities have announced that students planning to be on campus will need to be vaccinated for COVID-19. Residential colleges have long required students to be vaccinated for infectious diseases, but under the current emergency authorization, is it legal to require the COVID vaccine? That story today on All Things Considered. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.